Well, here we are, January 10th, the year started. This is Thomas Robb.
Jason Robb.
Rachel Pendergraft.
And we have a guest with us today from South Africa. And his name is, what's your name?
Eugene Opperman. Eugene Opperman.
Opperman, okay. All right, Eugene, we'll just call you Eugene.
That's fine.
Okay, and he's from South Africa. He's been in this country for a couple years. But we might be talking a little bit about South Africa, what's going on over there. Maybe could try to compare it with what's happening here in this country. So, anyway, cold outside.
Well, I know one thing that everything's a common denominator, whether it's in Germany, South Africa, the States, you got a big non-white problem.
Yeah.
So that's going to be the common denominator.
Well, they had all those over January 1st on the New Year's Eve. They had all those rapes in Cologne and other places.
Yeah.
Not just, I mean, that's made the news, but
Cologne, Germany.
It was all through Germany.
Yeah. Over 100,000 friendly non-white Muslims, you know, who wanted to spread their religion.
Spread their
peacefully
love.
Going and well, raping.
Well, it's a religion of love.
Yeah, love.
And they want to spread their love around.
Love, raping, you know, 1,000, you know, German girls if they're able to. You know, just go around and spread the love. And so that's, yeah, they did that on New Year's Eve. And that's only one instance that we are hearing about. You know, that's a suppression in the news media. They just were not able to contain in that area.
Right.
And you know there is other instances throughout Germany and Europe where you might have 100 or 200, I mean, who knows, Muslims going around trying to rape.
Yeah, but some of the politicians over there are trying to blame the German girls on it.
Right.
They were too provocative.
Well, that was blame the victims.
Yeah.
Well, the mayor there told the women that they should, you know, keep their distance and consider they should start covering up.
I read some suggestions. The other one was almost a racist suggestion. She said, stick with your own group. Did you see that?
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that sounds kind of excluding people that are not in your group.
Right.
But right. Stick with your own group. Try covering up more. I guess she wants to sell burkas or something.
Yeah. Well, there are, you can get like black trash bags at Walmart.
Yeah.
And they might be able to do that and put like a couple of
holes
and just wear that, you know, around, walking around, and
yeah.
And that could be their burkas.
Yeah.
You know, kind of attractive to me.
Kind of hot.
Yeah, yeah.
It's supposed to be hot in summer.
Exactly. I don't know if you have to put like a scarf around you, or that might be really flaunting it a little bit.
Well.
But that, well, you know, like we've talked about in the past, I think it's Holland, but one of those European countries. But now, before you can become a citizen in that country, it's directed mainly towards Muslims, but you have to go through a sex education class so you realize that you can't go out and rape the citizens.
Yeah.
You know, so you have to take a sex education class.
Yeah.
And so that's part of the law now.
And you got to earn the etiquette of the community.
Right. So once you become a citizen, then you can rape. But till then, you better or not.
Well, and then here about 3 or 4 weeks ago, there was that guy that wrote an article in France. He's actually being, he was actually arrested and they're investigating it now. But he said that women of the National Front should be raped and that they should, women who lean right, they should rape them and create multiracial.
Yeah, I saw that. He was an attorney.
Yeah.
He was an attorney. What are your colleagues, Jason?
What are my colleagues?
I have an attorney.
The guy who said that was an attorney.
Right.
A lawyer.
Yes.
So I'm making fun of you. I said, what are your colleagues?
Oh, not one of my colleagues. I thought it was like a question like, one of my colleagues, how do they think of it out here?
No.
So, okay.
I was just making fun of your profession.
Yes. Oh, and we could sit here all day long. Make fun of my profession.
Yeah, we could.
Yeah.
I just thought of a joke.
Exactly.
But I'll refrain.
But is there going to be any type of investigation?
They did arrest him.
They did?
And they That's are, I guess there's going to be a trial.
Yeah. Is he German? Is he white?
Yeah.
He's a white guy. Probably communist.
Probably Jewish. Yeah.
He's a socialist.
Yeah.
And they may not even say
that
he's probably Jewish,
just
too.
Just call me socialist.
Right.
Yeah.
Make that distinction there.
Yeah. Now, Eugene here is from, you're from South Africa.
Yes, Johannesburg.
Johannesburg. That's right down the bottom of South Africa?
No, that would be Cape Town. Johannesburg is more central.
Okay. All right. And that was settled by the Dutch, was it?
Yes, the Transvaal region, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So why? What's going on over South Africa?
A lot of problems, Pastor Rob. I see a lot of similarities from growing up before the revolution in South Africa. I grew up in the apartheid era with my age group.
Uh-huh.
And that was a wonderful time growing up in South Africa. Blacks were segregated from us. They needed special passports to be in a white neighborhood.
Now let me ask something there for people who may not know, and tell me if I'm wrong or not. But what I understand, to say they need a special passport sounds oppressive to some people. So why should a black person need a special passport to go into a white? Let me finish. Go to a white area. But as I understand it, these blacks were not citizens of South Africa. They came in to work in the diamond mines.
That's correct.
So they were foreigners.
Yes.
Just like a foreigner needs a passport to come to the United States.
Correct.
So they were foreigners who wanted to work in the diamond mines. They were allowed to come in, but only on the conditions that they lived in their own areas and governed themselves. Now, part that, they governed themselves, didn't they?
Yes.
So it wasn't like you had it wasn't like segregation where you had a white government oppressing them. They were a separate black nation within the boundaries of South Africa.
Yes.
And they were still foreigners. And that's why when they went into the rest of South Africa, they needed a passport, special papers.
Yes.
Because they were not citizens of South Africa.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And not all of them went to the diamond mines. Some went to the gold mines. Some went into the white neighborhoods, did a lot of manual labor, whether they were cooks for a white family or a gardener. And they would keep these documents on them so that if a certain time of day docks started happening, the police would stop them, the police would get their paperwork and get their master's information, which would be documented in their passports, to make sure that they had the right to be there. Mm-hmm. You know, and that they weren't looking at a terrorist, because we had a big problem with terrorism, which is why we had a shoot to kill policy at the border.
Uh-huh.
You know, a lot of terrorism from Angola, Botswana. We've been fighting with those for many, many years.
Yeah, the African, what is it called, African National Congress.
The African National Congress. Yes,
they were big. That's what Nelson Mandela was.
Yes, that's the Khoza tribe.
Yeah, and they were communists under Joseph Slovo.
That's correct. Yes.
And they're a big problem.
Yes.
So what's going on in South Africa today?
Well, after you have here in America, your affirmative action, the next step that came after that was what we called retrenchment, where it was there had to be so many blacks in the workplace, and you would come into work and find out that you were no longer employed. There were no severance packages given to white families. And you're talking about people in their 50s, who weren't going to be able to go out and get another job because of their age. You know, they were just left jobless, and that's why a lot of people immigrated, you know.
Yeah. Well, did you know anybody that immigrated? Now, you immigrated, but
yes,
did you know anybody else who immigrated?
I do, yes.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people have immigrated to the United Kingdom because that's... We were colonized by the British, so uh-huh. There's a lot of British descent there.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah. Do you still have contact with friends and family?
I do.
Africa?
Yes.
What do they describe the condition, or is it depending on their political thought? I mean, do they describe how the condition is in South Africa now? I mean, we kind of know how it is by looking on the internet about the murder rates and stuff like that, but how do they describe it?
Well, first off, they're a little scared to talk about it because nowadays with so many white liberals in the country and communists, you really don't know who it's safe to talk to anymore in fear of being reported to the government for necessarily being right-wing or having a different thought.
Right.
You know, next thing you know, you can be dragged out of your house and necklaced in the street.
Right.
Okay, for those who don't know what necklace means...
Is that pretty nice little jewelry around you?
No, unfortunately not. As much gold as we mine?
Yeah.
No.
Some people may not know what that means, so why don't you explain it to them?
Necklacing is where they take car tires, rubber car tires, and they put them around the human body, douse it in kerosene or petrol, which gasoline, and set it on fire. And it's a form of punishment.
And it kills the person.
It kills the person, yes. Yeah. They burn alive.
And a lot of that was... Now, that was done by... Nelson Mandela was involved in that.
That's correct,
His
yes.
wife, Winnie...
Winnie, yes.
...was involved in that a lot. Yes. And in fact, she was like the queen of necklacing, I think.
Yes.
Even the Canadian government recognized Winnie Mandela here about 8-9 years ago. They wanted... they didn't allow her to come in until there was a lot of repercussions with government officials because of her history with necklacing. And that was the government as a whole.
Yeah, now so she's still alive.
It became pretty wide.
Winnie Mandela is still alive, yes.
Yeah. And so Nelson Mandela, so this was done not just against whites, this was also done against blacks.
Against themselves, too.
Yeah, yes. Who they felt were traitors to their cause.
Oh, any excuse to necklace somebody is...
It gets another tribe.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Especially with the causes in the Zulu, they've pretty much been going at it like the Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland. You know, they've always fought over who has been in the South first. You know?
Right, so these are two tribes in Africa who are fighting, and they do politics. They hate each other, so they're just...
Yes.
Now, didn't the king of the Zulus here about 3 or 4 weeks ago said that South Africa was better off under... apartheid,
yes.
Than it is today. I don't know what his name was, do y'all recall him making that comment?
I remember. I can.
But he made the comment that South Africa was better off under apartheid than it is today.
It is. You know what a lot of people don't realize is that when you come to the world global financial charts, where you see the exchange rates for money, we've always known the British sterling pound to be at the top. And, you know, the American dollar, which has now slipped under the euro now, many, many years ago, the South African rand was 1-1 to the British sterling pound. But because of our apartheid and the world holding sanctions against us, we weren't noticed as holding a strong currency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Zulu King Goodwill Zwelithini.
That sounds good to me.
Zwelithini. Zwelithini.
Sounds Italian.
Yeah. And it says, the official king of South Africa's Zulu tribe since December of 1971 made the remarks during a speech at an official royal household event in Nongoma.
Yes.
Located in the northeastern part of the Eastern Seaboard province. And then he said that the country was economically, military, and socially better under white Afrikaner rule, and that history will judge blacks as only having destroyed everything that they had inherited from the white government.
Yeah. That's a pretty amazing statement.
Yeah.
You know.
That's a picture. No one can do that, but...
Yeah.
I just Googled it. I said, King Zulu in South Africa makes statement.
Instead of Angela Merkel being the Times Person of the Year, they should have made him the Times
absolutely.
Person of the Year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Making the most true statement that's one of the most true statements that's ever been made.
Yeah. But other blacks have recognized that same type of thing. James Meredith, who changed to a more of a African name, but he was the man who, I don't know if you're familiar with this or not, Eugene, but he was a fellow who was the instrument in breaking the color barrier at Ole Miss back in the 60s. And he was led all kinds of federal marshes and so forth, and he broke the color barrier. They allowed him, that's what allowed blacks as students at Ole Miss. But he has come out now here, well, he's dead now, I think, but 15 years ago or more, he said that the worst thing that happened to Negroes or black people was the
white liberals,
yeah. Because they destroyed the black economy, the black community, the black families. Because back in the 50 years ago, black families were pretty stable.
Yeah,
and like 85% of the black families had a mother and father at home. Now it's like 5% or 7%, you know. And So they've destroyed the black family, black economy, mm-hmm. and I know, and the neighborhoods were safe.
Yeah.
My dad used to sell insurance. We used to go. He used to go into the black neighborhoods in Detroit, and the neighborhoods are safe. but the same thing happened, and this is universally the same. Rachel was reading a book here of back a while back, which I've had in my library. In fact, I got several copies of them. I'll give you one, Brent, Eugene, called Rhodesia.
Yeah.
And they talk about the number of students, black students, who were being educated by the government. It was like 94-95%
right.
of black children in Rhodesia were being educated in public school.
Yeah, and this is a book that was contemporary with the fight to keep Rhodesia from being broken down and given over to black rule.
Right.
So it was like a book that... These are the current stats,
yeah.
not like a propaganda piece looking back years right. later.
Yeah.
And today, what is today the at black
I think
children
it's like 5 or 6%
are in school.
Even in school yeah. under yeah. black rule?
Yeah, I don't know how it is in Rhodesia now, but I know in South Africa after the change after 1994, when we started getting what they called gray schools, when black mm-hmm. students could attend white schools. South Africa was renowned for its education. We were on the British rule of education, which is a very good standard of education.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But they lowered the standard of education for black children to go to school.
Yeah.
I remember being in school, and there was a family that came from Texas. Their father worked for an oil company. And Jeremy, his name was put back 2 grades because he had to write a test. And they had to see where he was academically, and they put him back 2 grades just because of our standard of education compared to the American standard of education. You know, but now in South Africa, it's dropped.
Yeah. Well, they've done that in this country, too, and I'm sure all through South Africa. In fact, probably, I'm sure all the other all-white countries, they've lowered the academic education, so much in order to...
Elevate
blacks, but make the percentage of difference, try to make it disappear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you see, whites are performing the same as blacks at the mm-hmm. same level. And the only way they can do that is lower the standards to just a drastic amount
mm-hmm.
that it becomes camouflage, which mm-hmm. the difference is. But and that's why our education in this country is being, in other countries, being devastated.
Well, and it always comes back to, well, you know, supposedly it's because, you know, their schools don't have enough financing, or it's because the tax base is different and so forth. And so we need, you know, well, that was the whole drive behind, you know, the kindergarten movement here in the United States. You know, the kindergarten was started for a different reason in Germany, but here in the United States it was started basically as a, well, we have to get blacks into school earlier. Now
it's preschool.
Kindergarten here in the United States, and then preschool, and then Head Start, and now they're talking about, well, now we need year-round boarding schools. They're wanting to finance year-round boarding schools for at-risk minority students because, well, you know, they may have, you know, this good school that the government's paying for here, but then they go home and they don't have the benefits, or in the morning they don't have the benefits. And they always come back to the fact that for some reason it's money has something to do with the fact that they don't achieve on the same level as whites do. And yet you look at white rural school districts who don't have near the tax base or financing that a lot of your black districts have, and they still manage somehow to achieve and excel and do great on state standardized testing.
Well, you can throw all the money in the world, but 2 + 2 = 4.
Right.
But they think that, well, we need to put more
money
into the system.
Well, maybe not according to new math.
No, the new math, it may not be 4, it could be 5, depending how you get to that answer.
As long as you try.
Yeah. But that's...
Your answer may be wrong, but you try, and we want to encourage you for your willingness to expand and imagine new frontiers.
You don't get first place, you just you get an award for trying. But no, that's actually true. It's just we need to throw more money. And then, like you said, Rachel, the year-round schooling, it's a basically a way to babysit
them. Right. And they haven't initially started it yet, but there's a huge move towards it. And they're really trying to work with the National Education Association along with the Board of Education to provide federal money to do that, to build in your inner cities year-round boarding schools.
No telling how much millions and millions and millions of dollars are
billions
of dollars being spent on these programs that up to this point have not gained even a sliver of success.
Right. Yeah. Well, and if they don't, you know, it's really and it's unfair to them because, you know, the worst thing to a person's self-esteem is to give them false expectations.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, I think, you know, James Meredith probably recognized that and mentioned about the white liberals is because they're saying, okay, you can do this. You can be a physicist. You can be an astro engineer. You can be this and this and this and this and everything. And when they are unable year after year to lift their communities up to these expected standards,
they gotta blame somebody.
Someone has to be at blame.
Yeah. Yeah.
And is it the lead paint on the walls and the, you know, the inner city projects? I mean, I don't know. There's houses around here in rural Arkansas that still have lead paint and lead pipes, and yet our students are still excelling statewide standards with the same tax base as black districts in southern Arkansas that are failing miserably.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just continue to try to find a scapegoat.
Right.
And it's always white people.
Well, that's the whole society, you know, as a whole, when you're dealing with non-whites programs, is that you have to blame somebody. You know, and the establishment is who to blame, and the establishment traditionally has been white people.
Right.
So they're the ones behind the blame because they're teaching, and they'll go in as far as say their teaching methods is racist. You know, because blacks can't understand the teaching method because the teaching method of the whites are your colonization and from your Western teachings.
Right.
You know, where the blacks, that's not their way they are taught, and it's not their history. You know, and so when they talk about, you know, Western civilization, well, that's not part of their culture. So they got to look at anything to blame.
I'm just so surprised here in America how the white Americans seem to go overboard in a way in trying to accommodate the black students. It's like they're going out of their way to make
easier. Guilt. You know, we've got such a heavy hand of guilt placed on people, and they feel it's their fault. You know, and these black students would be brain surgeons and nuclear scientists and so forth. And speaking about brain surgeons, I know somebody might bring up Ben Carson and say, well, he was a noted neurologist and so forth, which he was. I'm not going to say he wasn't a smart man. He obviously is. But we don't know everything that went on there either. How many other smart white brain surgeons or potential surgeons were denied promotions or not denied recognition
or admission to medical school?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, to get in when you're a black, you're already, with affirmative action, you're already allowed to have extra points to get into the programs.
I know a number of years ago I read the book by Colin Powell called My American Journey. I read a biography. It was a big, thick book, and I read it. I thought there'd be something to learn in here.
You read a big, thick book.
I read a big book. Anyway, My American Journey by General Colin Powell, who's considered one of a great general, okay, in American people today, and recognized as being an outstanding military genius and so on. But when you read his book, it's amazing because about a dozen times he made comments like, I can't believe it. I'm getting a promotion already. I've only been in the program for 30 days. You have to be in it for 6 months. Already I'm being promoted. Wow, I can't believe it. But time and time and time again. You know, I can't believe it. I've been sent to offer school. I can't believe it. How did that happen?
Usually it takes a couple years then to get eligible.
Yeah, I got it within 30 days. Well, how did that happen? I know how it happened.
Well, I mean, it would be considered racist to say, but I would say that for every non-white that is admitted to any you know, university or postgraduate type program or anything like that, for everyone that's admitted, there's an equally or better qualified white person that was not allowed to get, that was excluded to let that person in.
Right. So back to Ben Carson. I hear he's a smart man. Nobody's going to say he's not smart. Mm-hmm. He's educated. He, you know, he had.
I mean, if you want brain surgery, you would probably rather have him than me.
Right.
I've had no brain surgery training.
Right. Yeah. So we're not saying he's not a smart man. What we are question is who was bypassed.
Right.
To allow him to take that position.
Right.
And they might, and people have been. Told the Blarney that, well, we owe it to them. Well, I don't know what we owe it to, but you look at the way that black people live in this country, compare how they live in Africa, and I think they are doing pretty well. I don't think the average black tribal person in Africa is running around with cell phones, you know, nope. Color TVs, nope. And air-conditioned homes.
I do see a lot of Nike shirts, though.
That one by missionaries sent them. The bulls are wearing over there was gifts to them from missionaries.
Yeah. Well, just look at Detroit now. You know, in the United States, all the blacks. I mean, it's run by blacks. The government's, you know, run by blacks. The population is overwhelming in black society. And the high crime area, unemployment, I mean, just everything bad. Now, you reverse that 50 years ago, right, when Detroit was a majority of white city, and blacks still lived parts of there, the family structure was still intact, the blacks were still employed, they still had safe schools, safe neighborhoods. So, I mean, I guarantee the blacks back then rather still be living during that time period than now.
Oh, absolutely. I don't doubt that a bit. I don't doubt that a bit. The Eugene, the over there in South Africa, okay. The how much longer can it survive?
No idea. You know, we're
and who's propping up the economy now? Is it still the whites propping up the economy?
Yes,
but also South Africa, the rape capital of the world, isn't it? Or
yes, the AIDS capital too.
How much longer can that little clean soap bubble in the sewer float down that sewer before it pops?
Well, the thing is, Ponsarab, is what a lot of people don't know is that when the world held sanctions against South Africa for apartheid, if you look at South Africa, there used to be Southwest Africa, which is now known as Namibia. America and Great Britain were the two biggest mouths when it came to the sanctions for the apartheid. But America and Great Britain and a lot of the European countries still needed the diamonds that were mined from De Beers, 86% of the world's diamonds, in fact, mm-hmm. and our gold and our platinum, which was, and iron ore, which was shipped to the Far East for car engines and so on and so forth.
Now, they had the huge diamond mines and gold mines and platinum mines in South Africa. When the whites came there, they stole them from the Negroes?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. They were walking on top of it with their bare feet.
All right. So the Dutch and the whites didn't go there to steal the diamond mines away.
No.
They had no diamond mines.
No.
They had no gold mines.
No.
They had no platinum mines.
No, simply
did they have anything?
No. Spears and...
spears and darts? And they didn't have necklaces because they didn't have rubber tires.
No. No. But When Namibia was formed and given its national anthem and given a flag, the rest of the world was buying now from Namibia. They weren't buying from South Africa. Uh-huh. South Africa was self-sufficient through the apartheid era, even though the world was holding sanctions against us. We've grown our own food, wheat and so on and so forth. I export some wines and foods, and we don't have to import anything into the country to survive. We're self-sufficient.
Uh-huh. And Rhodesia was also, wasn't it?
Now, I'm not too sure about that. I was a little bit before my time.
Yeah. Rhodesia is a country. There's it doesn't border South Africa.
No.
There's what's in between?
Botswana, I believe it is.
Is between?
Yeah.
And does Rhodesia border the ocean at all?
No. Okay. It's pretty much central.
It's inland.
Yes. Okay.
But it was a very prosperous country. I knew it was very prosperous and exported foodstuffs mm-hmm. Throughout the world mm-hmm. Until they were forced to accept one man, one vote rule.
Right.
Same thing in South Africa.
Pretty much, yes.
I got a picture on my on my laptop.
Okay. Now, that's South Africa.
Well, when Eugene was talking about the mines and stuff like that, this is an article about the mines and and talks about the Land Act of 1917, which they talk about taking all the indigenous people and pushing these areas, and talks about the Land Act of 1917. All it actually did was secure that location where they were already at and said this is their land. So they didn't say, oh, hey, all you blacks have to move here.
They protected it.
Protected it. Yeah. Now, like you have the Indian tribes in America or whatever. Yeah. But those people were already there at certain little places, not all of South Africa, little tribes, and they just secured that place. But
now, I was told, Eugene, to correct me on this if I'm wrong or verify it if I'm right, that South Africa, when the Dutch settled there, there were no blacks even living in the area.
There were no blacks to be found.
Now, how far north? I mean, just at Cape Town, or the whole area was...
Well, Cape Town, which was always known as the Cape of Storms or the Cape of Good Hope in the beginning, was founded in 1652 by Jan van Riebeck. He was from Holland.
Uh-huh.
And the Cape was used as a route to the east for spices that were going back to Europe.
It was a stopping off point. A rest stop.
Correct. Uh-huh. When the Boers decided to settle, and the Great Trek arrived, and took off into South Africa, and they reached the Transvaal region, which is part of the center of the country, heading up north, that's where the Boers ran into the Zulus. And that's where it comes to Battle of the Blood River that everybody's
talking about. Right, I was going to ask you to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, the Battle of the Blood River was basically the Boers and the Zulu tribe fighting over land. We're not too sure to this day. No one can really tell where the Zulus came from, but the Boers were so far north that they could not have been in South Africa at that time.
Right.
And the causes were nowhere even heard of.
Okay. Flip the, I know people on radio can't see this. Flip that computer around, Jason.
Okay.
So Eugene can see it. Whereabouts, I know you can't see it on here, but for our own, and we'll try to talk about
where's Blood River at?
Where's Blood River at?
Okay.
Are you able to point that out?
Let me take a closer look here, if I may. Thank you. Okay.
And all they have to do is simply type in South Africa map or whatever.
Yeah.
But that's an article as well talking about the so-called blacks, and there's an archaeologist says
so it's up in that region. That's
it's up in the region
in the
northwestern region.
How far north we say that is from the Cape Town
in miles?
Yeah.
Johannesburg is 2,000 kilometers. I'm not sure of the.
I don't do the kilometers.
Yeah, I know.
Kilometers are more than miles.
Yeah.
The word are longer, too.
It is.
Yeah. Miles just has four letters.
I think it's about 1,500 miles.
Well, Johannesburg, I would say, on the safe side, I'd say about 2,200 miles.
Okay. Oh, that's 2,000. So they had to travel 2,000 miles north from Cape Town before they brought in the first blacks.
Yes.
And it's the same in this country. People have the idea that Indians were just living all over the place, little communities over every hill, another Indian community. And it wasn't that way. That's why the settlers felt safe. They could set a homestead in Kansas or Oklahoma or something and felt safe because there was no Indians within hundreds of miles up here. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, one day, some Indian tribe came over the hillside and decided, oh, there's looks like easy victims. Mm-hmm. And they attacked them and scalped them. Then the army came in. Mm-hmm. The army came in to protect the settlers. They had the idea so often in this country, and I'm sure the same thing in South Africa. So often people have the idea here that the army was just sent off west to kill Indians. And the army went west to protect the settlers. They did not go out to kill Indians. They went to protect the settlers. And when the settlers got attacked, then the army went and took care of business.
But not only that, General Custer was praised by a number of what they referred to as peaceful Indian tribes for protecting them against some of the warring tribes.
Right.
The very violent war-type tribes.
Right.
And he was beloved by several peaceful Indian tribes that, did more, they didn't try to go and conquer other Indian tribes. They just kind of did their little nomadic thing and lived in their teepees and stuff like yeah. that. And
well, kind of like with the Zulu King
yes.
saying that the, making the same comment. We were safe under the white rule, that we're not safe now.
Right.
And these Indians say we were safe because to help keep the peaceful tribes safe for the more warlike tribes. But, you know, the point is that Indians did not just live in communities and didn't have industrial complexes and factories where people, the Indians wake up in the morning, stretch, oh, come go work in the factory, in the bead factory down there, right. make beads, you know. So South Africa, the same way. There were not Africans living all over the continent of Africa.
No.
There had a little tiny nesting of African tribes in certain areas mm-hmm. that were not densely populated by Africans. And you had to go 2,000 miles north from where the Dutch settled Cape Town. What was his name? Ribbick?
Jan van Ribbick.
Ribbick. And 2,000 miles north where you confront the first blacks.
Yeah.
And then I don't know the name, you probably, the name of the Dutch off of the Boer who encountered the conflict, the Blood River, and I know it was quite a, in South Africa, it was quite a historical event in South Africa, this battle, because I think very few of the Boers were killed, and yet they overcome a powerful Zulu force. Is that correct?
That's correct, because the Zulus had spears and the Boers had rifles.
So. Right. Well, and, you know, there's a big monument there built to yes. to that fellow. Now, I don't know what's happened to that monument today. They probably want to tear it down just because they didn't want to tear down the monuments in our country.
The quote-unquote new South Africa have wanted to tear down a lot of national monuments. Some have been torn down.
Yeah.
Which, you know, if you think about it, a lot of people don't realize what that means. And if I can kind of just reiterate on that, is that that would be like America getting its first black president. And I don't mean Obama or anything like that. I'm talking an official black president that's a white hater.
Yeah.
And takes the American flag.
Obviously a white hater.
The stars yeah. and stripes and says, you know what? This flag has to deal with the old white government. Forget it. We're going to make a new flag for America.
And that's what they did in South
that's
Africa.
That's what they did to South Africa.
Now, you know, it's not the same. The South African flag today is not the same flag that you had growing up.
Correct. They would take your national anthem and discard it. And bring in a tribal national anthem, which is sung in Xhosa now, in Nkosi Sikelel' iAfrika, which means God bless Africa. Our national monuments have been trying to be torn down. Now, there are certain sectors of South Africa that are still protected, fortunately, by the AWB, and of national monuments that are protected that won't be taken down. But in the city of Cape Town, Jan van Riebeeck and his wife Marie, their statues have been taken down, and they were the founders.
Yeah,
you know, and you know, it's so sad to see
like over here and,
history going down.
Well, you know, that's sort of what they're the same thing to do in this country in. And we don't have one man as a founder, but, you know, they want to totally destroy the image of Christopher Columbus,
mm-hmm.
you know, the pilgrims. They mm-hmm. want to destroy all our early settlers as being just people came and raped the land, were destroyers. And so, and they're doing that, of course, with all our monuments that recognize
well, and they'll be dismantling everything with George and Washington.
George Washington.
Martha absolutely. Washington pretty soon.
Absolutely.
And Thomas Jefferson. They've already gotten statues trying to be removed with Thomas Jefferson and
yeah.
And even George Washington. So.
And surprisingly, it hadn't got a foothold yet, but there are, except for Ninth Circuit Court, to dishonor the American flag. Mm-hmm. The Ninth Circuit Court says that the American flag of a school district or a government building wants to not put up the American flag because it might be offensive to Mexicans, mm-hmm. the flag should be lowered.
Mm-hmm.
It's happening in this country either, and people also, and it's only going to grow in intensity until white people reach the level of what I call berserker.
And what the thing is that what I realize in America is that whenever there's some form of, if you want to call it hatred or ill doing towards a black person from a white person, it's broadcasted all over the news and the radio and the newspapers. But vice versa, if a black person is to do ill on a white person, You don't really hear about it. But what shocked me the most is that I saw a documentary on television of someone that went into a black neighborhood called Harlem, and they were burning American flags. They were laying the flags on the ground for people to walk over and telling them, walk over your white government. You know, and it's scary.
Right.
And white people don't see this.
Well, they don't see it. It's not broadcast. And
no.
Thankfully, to the internet now, that information does get out to people, right. But not being broadcast on your news. Yeah. Yes, absolutely not.
Well, when you take little white children from their earliest days in school and teach them, you know, 5 days a week, 10 months a year, that their people have oppressed, their people are haters, their people have done this, their people have done that. They're just an evil people. And talk about brainwashing little children. They grow up and then they're off to high school and privilege walks and, oh, white people are so privileged or white people are this or, you know, you have to excuse the violence in black neighborhoods because they're frustrated.
Yeah,
that's what happens when you're frustrated, you know?
Yeah.
And it's, you know, we want to blame the white people, but then, you know, you also have to understand their mental conditioning.
Yeah.
That they've undergone. And that's why this, what's happening with the non-whites coming into our country at such an accelerated rate. On one hand, it's not good, but on the other hand, there have to be something like kind of like a snapping, you know, rubber band to snap these people out of the delusion that they're under.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned too, Eugene, about the about if a white commits a crime, everybody hears about it. So the according to the FBI in this country, if you're a Mexican. And you're the victim of a hate crime. You're listed as a minority. Mm-hmm. But if you're a Mexican and you go out and commit a hate crime against a black person, mm-hmm. the statistic place you as a white person. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the so-called white crimes that we hear about aren't really committed by white people. If you go to the post office, and I challenge anybody to do this, they can verify it for themselves. You can go to the post office, look at the wanted posters at the post office, mm-hmm. and they'll list people from India, they'll list people from the Arab countries. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they'll put in their nationality, Saudi Arabia, race white, or mm-hmm. nationality, India, race white. And so they're listing a lot of these people as white only because they're not Negro.
Right.
And I know this sounds crazy, and it is crazy, that's why people almost have to go to the post office to see what I'm saying is true.
Well, yeah. Even just here in Texas, here about 6 weeks ago, they did an undercover investigation and found that up to 60% of the people that are stopped in Texas by the Texas State Police for traffic violations, which then lead often to other types of arrests and so forth, that they are putting on their papers reports that they are white, even though the people are not white, because the Texas State Police are fearful of being accused of racial profiling. Mm. And so many police departments are taking their reports and they're basically falsifying. They're not trying to do anything wrong, but they're falsifying the ethnicity of the people they stop so that they don't get in trouble for racial profiling.
By the FBI.
Right.
The federal government.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's horrible how people are being misled. So, like Rachel was mentioning before, you get young kids and they don't know any better. They're being manipulated and minds are being twisted and channeled down directions of a direction of ignorance. And I don't mean ignorance from the standpoint of an insult, it's just not knowing, lacking of information.
Yeah.
And so,
well, one good thing I think that is happening with the like the U.S. Census Bureau and so forth, if there is such, you know, white people always say, you know, well, I don't see race, you know, it's just, if just the color of a person's heart, I don't see their skin color and so forth. And white people think when they say that they're being kind and benevolent, but it makes non-white people very angry because they say, well, wait, you're trying to deny my race. I'm a proud black woman, blah, blah, blah. You know, absolutely. I'm a proud this or proud that. Why are you trying to deny my race? How can you say that you don't see skin color? This is what I am. And there's enough people like that that are fed up with the Census Bureau's way of compiling the statistics for the U.S. on the demographics and racial statuses that in the next census that comes out, people from the Middle East, they're going to have a designation for them. People from India, they'll have a designation for them. And so a lot of these people on the U.S. census that have been described or counted as white prior to this next coming census will now have an option to mark themselves, or as mixed race also, to be able to mark themselves as not being white. And what's that, I think, is going to be beneficial, because that's going to drastically alter the perception that people have as of this being a majority white nation still, because it's not. And that's going to give a lot of mobility to non-white people to clamor for even more, you know, extra rights and so forth. That's going to help them kind of get their marching accelerated a little bit. And the more that they do, you know, like we mentioned before, these white kids that have been in this delusional bubble, they need a knock on the head. And so anything that people do against the white race to kind of knock some sense into them or get that delusion wiped out of their minds is good. And that, you know, the change to the census, you know, we always thought, you know, as Christians, we always remember that, you know, everything that happens is going to ultimately have a positive benefit for us because we're God's people.
Right. And, well, that's why the work of the Knights is so important, because people are entering what I call the Dark Ages in America. There's a dark cloud descending upon our nation, upon our people, and they need hope. They need direction, and we have something to offer them. We have something to offer them. not because we're the smartest people in the world, and we're going to come up with a better plan than anybody else has. It's because we recognize that ultimately there is no help but in the Lord. That is where our hope is from. Is returned back to the Christian. To Christ and to re-engage our people with the principle that Jesus Christ taught us to love our God and love our people. And we feel that the Knights are, in a sense, a missionary program. We're evangelists taking the gospel of good news, which Christ talked about, the gospel of the kingdom. We got the gospel, the good news of God's government that is going to overpower and overcome and conquer the rebellion that had been existing for years, but we see it growing in intensity today. This anti-white rebellion that is not just in your community where you live or the state you live in, but is a national rebellion, a worldwide rebellion. It makes no difference if it's America, whether it's in Germany, whether it's in the Scandinavian countries, whether it's in South Africa. There's a worldwide rebellion, a satanic rebellion against God's people. And we believe that we, as well as others, have a message of hope and deliverance for our people. So the work of the Knights is very important, and people's supporting the Knights is very important.
Absolutely. Well, you know, there's a lot of good people out there that are working for change. There's people that are working to try to save the Constitution. There's people that are working for self-government. There's people that are working for to retain the, you know, educational benefits for white people or economic benefits. There's a lot of people out there that are trying to work for white causes and white rights. But what, like you said, Pastor Rob, the thing that I think makes the Knights unique is, it's like we were telling a reporter here last week with the Washington Post, what makes us unique is that we are actually asking our people to repent of their lack of compassion for each other. Mm-hmm. And based upon that repentance, then all of these other things that other organizations and groups and people are working for, that all hinges on the repentance of our people.
Right.
And that's
why... It's more than just knowing what the enemy's doing.
Right.
It's more than knowing how powerful the enemy is. It's more than knowing about the atrocities committed against our people. All those things are happening on the outside. But what we're saying is something has to happen on the inside. Something has to happen within our hearts. And that is what Christ called repentance. And we as a people in our hearts need to repent of our lack of loving our God and loving our people. And with that act of repentance, God can then work with us and bring about national revival to our nation and people.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, you know, the NICE has a history of decades of leadership within the white resistance of awakening our people, you know. And, you know, that's why, you know, we've been saying here for the last several years where the NICE really has become the voice of the white resistance. I mean, literally, throughout the week, you know, we're getting phone calls from reporters, not only in the United States, but in Europe, wanting to know what the viewpoint of the white resistance on various topics.
Right.
It could be on the economy. It could be on immigration. It could be on maybe...
The presidential campaign?
Presidential campaign.
Richard did an interview last week with Politico. Regarding the presidential campaign.
Right. So the thing is, they recognize the Knights not only as a Klan organization, but more importantly, they're recognizing the Knights as this is the voice of the white resistance. What does the white resistance think of? And what's their views, you know, on various topics? And so they come to us to get that. And that is something the Knights have been working on for decades, you know. And the media, the establishment, they have recognized that the Knights really have become the voice of the white resistance. And that is very important because it really, the Knights, like I said, we've been in this for over 50 years, I mean decades. And the thing is that we have a track record, we're well established, we have a secure location. So everything we've been working for has been really to get us to where we are at now. And so it's very important that people, you know, that's listening to this recognize that the association with the Knights is a very big deal, you know. And when you associate with the Knights, you know, you're associating with a network of people throughout the United States that have a concern about what's happening with America and throughout their country. Because even though there might be white people in other countries, there are still our brothers and sisters. You know, right. They may be Germans, they may be Finnish or South Africans, but they're all our people. They're all our nations.
Right.
You know?
And a lot of older people, I hear a lot of older people, they say, make comments, and it's really, really selfish, but they make comments, well, I'm old, I'm just glad that I'm not going to live to see the problems. You know, but set that aside, there are young people who are going to have to live into those problems.
Absolutely.
And I know as youth corps director, you get emails, you get contacts from kids who don't see any hope.
They don't.
They see
don't.
No hope. They see a nation that is falling apart.
The night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, last show, you know, we had talked about just a couple of the ones that had joined over the holidays. There was several that joined over the holidays, Christmas and New Year's break. But, you know, there's the one that Amanda from California, and there was William from Kentucky. We had another one a couple days ago that had joined from Detroit. And these are all white kids that are in the 10th, 11th grade, and they don't see hope out there, you know. And then when they get into on our website, they start getting communication. They know there are other people out there that have the concern that wants to fight for their future, and it inspires them. It gives them hope to know that, hey, there are other people out there that have concern with me. My mom and dad may not care about me. My neighbors may not care about me. Definitely the school systems don't care about me, but these people, they care about my future.
And what they like, Jason, is that they're not just joining us and then sitting around and hearing a bunch of black jokes.
No.
Or talking bad about black. It's a program. It's an idea.
We have progressive, strategic
put something, and it puts something into the heart, into the soul.
Well,
there is a hope here, and you can connect with the Lord. You can connect with your Creator. You can connect with your Christian faith. And as Christian people, move forward with them in this message of hope.
And like we talked about last week, you know, these kids, Amanda and William and others that have joined, we don't know what position they're going to be in 10, 15, 20 years. I mean, we have to look at that. They are our future leaders. We don't know Amanda. She could be a congressman or a state legislator in California in the cesspool that's spreading this white Christian revival at the state legislation. No, we don't know about William in Kentucky, who may be a business owner that can financially support the white resistance. I mean, these kids are our future. And so often people neglect any type of value on these kids. And that's what's so dynamic about the Knights, is, and especially the Youth Corps, is it gives them a sense of hope and gives them direction on how they can better themselves and better their own people when they get older.
Absolutely.
And we know at the Youth Corps program, they have the academy that they go through, talking about the history of the United States and talking about not the lies that they're hearing about in the school systems, but the unfiltered truth, of...
You have a right to be white and proud.
Absolutely.
You have a right to be white and proud.
Yeah.
So.
And so it's a dynamic organization. The Knights is a dynamic organization, and something that people that are listening to this really need to look out, read about the Knights, and see what the programs that's going on.
Well, that's why it's so important people get behind this building project of the Christian Revival Research and Development Center, because it is going to be a catalyst for New America, a catalyst for training young people, a catalyst for really organizing and grooming future leaders and implementing long-term strategy to fill that void and vacuum that's going to occur in the heartland of America when it comes to white leadership. We're not just planning for tomorrow or a conference in a few months. We're planning for years from now. We're the ones doing that.
Yeah, we've always been ones who focus on not in membership. You don't win the battle by having a bunch of members. You win the battle by having leadership. Leadership that can be humble themselves before the Lord, who can humble themselves before their people, and take this message. And that's what we've always concentrated on, creating leaders who can be a dynamic force to take this message to people.
Well, we recognize that with God being in control, God has never used the masses to reach his people. I mean, he's only used the dedicated people to turn events around. You look in the Bible, and time again, he doesn't need a lot of people.
God can save by many, or can save by few.
Right.
It says,
and
he needs the few to save the many.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But that's kind of the principles that we've always worked on. From that standpoint, is the good solid foundation, and always working strategy wise, 10, 15, 20, 30 years ahead of today's time, we're always looking for that. And so, the Christian Research and Development Center is going to be a beautiful site, a beautiful building. And for strategy-wise, simply no one else is even remotely doing anything like Knights. It's just not occurring.
Back to you, Eugene. How does it feel? I can well imagine, and we're going to close this up really quick because we're about to our limit, but... I know how I feel about what I see happen to America, but in your case, South Africa was your country. That's where you're born.
Yes.
You were a little guy running around the streets of
Johannesburg.
Johannesburg.
But it was safe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you must look at South Africa today. It must rip your heart up.
It does. It does. And I've made America my home now for the last couple decades, and I see the birth pains in America. That's what I call them, the signs that what's to come. America is still in a good position right now. A lot of people don't see it. They think it's the end right now, but it's not quite. We can still do something. We can still do something. And what gets me here in America is just your different organizations. Like in South Africa, we had the AWB. And if you want to go with the white resistance movement, you went with the AWB. They weren't these different branches of everybody kind of formed together and made one big, strong resistance. Mm-hmm. And that's how we were able to form the apartheid. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to see something like that happen in America, yeah. You know?
Things like that will happen organically. You can't force it to happen. Sure. You know, you can't meet in a conference and just make a decision. It's going to happen organically. Mm-hmm. And our program with the Knights has always been to become the source of propaganda.
We will be the AWB of America.
Yeah.
That will be nice.
So,
goal. And it's,
anyway, we're going to wrap this up. Any final words, guys?
No, main thing is, no, we're in 2016. Remain dedicated, to your people. Now more than ever, get behind the Knights. Get behind this dynamic organization.
Spread. Tell your friends about the KKK Radio.
Yep. And Faith and Freedom Conference coming up April 29, 30, and May 1st. Three big days. We're going to be celebrating.
It's a Christian gathering.
It's a Christian gathering.
Some people get the idea that it's going to be all this strange stuff. You know, it's a Christian gathering of families who love America.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, all right, April when?
April 29, 30, and May 1st.
All right.
And we'll have a lot of good speakers and celebration. We're going to be celebrating the 50th year of your ordination. And just a lot of great things happening.
All right. Well, Eugene, appreciate you being with us on this show.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, and this is Thomas Robb and
Jason Robb.
Rachel Pendergrass.
And until next time, remind you to love your God and love your people.